Thanks, and thanks everyone for coming. Thank you for inviting me. Okay. So this is going to be, in some ways, a more philosophical talk than I normally give. So I feel as if a group of physicists invite a philosopher to come, you better perform, you know, show going to do some philosophy. And the question that I'm taking up is, I think, a deep and important one, one that I think does motivate some physicists, but certainly has motivated many philosophers, which is, we'd like to be able to say something about what the world is like. You can put this in various ways. You can say, well, we'd like to be able to describe the fundamental structure of the world, any structure of the world. And we'd like to think that if we're going to do this in a responsible way, that we had better be looking to our best physical theories for guidance. Now, I think not everyone, but many, many people would agree with that much. Disagreement starts very quickly thereafter, though, because the question of just how to get from a physical theory to some clear characterization of what you might think of as the structure of the world turns out to be pretty difficult. So here's one barrier that comes up. Physical theories often emit many formulations. And in fact, it's quite fruitful when we're doing physics to have different formulations of a theory at hand that we can pull off the shelf and use for solving problems. But these different formulations, at least on their face, may appear to give different answers to the sort of question that a certain kind of philosopher might want to ask. So, for instance, they might seem to posit different sorts of entities. They might have different ontologies. They might seem to characterize things in terms of different sorts of possible relations that these entities might bear to one another, and so on. And in at least some cases, we might have different formulations of a theory where it seems as if they both formulations are doing a perfectly good job. We use them for different purposes. Sometimes it's important or convenient, at least, to be able to have access to each of them. And yet we tend to think that one of them somehow posits strictly more than another, or strictly more than is necessary. We say that it has excess structure. So what are we supposed to do with this? I have two pictures like this in the talk. I think the other one's funnier. Okay, so let me give an example of how this sort of thing sometimes plays out in the philosophical literature. And so in 2009, a philosopher of physics named Jill North, who was at that point at Cornell, wrote a paper called The Structure of Physics, a Case Study, in which she argued that Hamiltonian mechanics is more fundamental than Lagrangian mechanics. Implicit in this is an idea that there's some essential difference, that there's some sense in which these are inequivalent theories, that we should somehow prefer one over the other, and moreover, that Hamiltonian mechanics is the one that we should prefer for the purposes of trying to extract some sort of information about what the fundamental structure of the world, I guess not our world, but a world described in the appropriate way by Hamiltonian mechanics. Eric Curiel, another philosopher of physics, now in Munich, wrote, it was much closer to 2009 than the data publication suggests, another paper, which he argued exactly the opposite. I mean, he you know, held more or less the same basic background assumptions that, you know, there are some substantial senses in which these are inequivalent. We should be trying to pick one. He thinks we should pick Lagrangian mechanics. Yeah.
You mentioned that two formulations of a theory may give two different answers. And then you said that could be or be relevant or be different for philosophers. Would you mean that they would also be for physicists different, or that cases where physicists don't mind, but a philosopher would? Or did you have an example in mind? Maybe that's
so I'm going to describe a number of examples going forward. So I guess I think that there are lots of projects that physicists may be engaged in. And so, you know, one thing you might be trying to do, for instance, is come up with a quantum theory of gravity. Maybe the way in which you'd like to do that is to try to say, well, there are lots of ways of thinking about general relativity, but, you know, here's the way that really gets at what's fundamentally going on. These are the real, you know, observable quantities, for instance, that I think that my quantum theory ought to recover. And that sort of project looks a lot like this sort of project, I think, where you're trying to, you're looking at different formulations and you're trying to say which, if any of them, is somehow more perspicuous.
Maybe physicists don't mind that they might give different answers, each of the formulations, but philosophers would raise an issue with those differences. And
I take this to be a case where I think most people who have spent time working with Lagrangian Hamiltonian mechanics, just purely classically, would say, they're more or less doing the same sort of thing. We've got some control over the way in which they're doing the same sort of thing. But North and Curiel have come along and said, no, there's some substantive difference. And so I'm trying to describe the kind of dialectic that happens here, because in the next two papers I'm going to mention, Hans Halvorsen, Noel Swanson, and Thomas Barrett, in both cases what these papers are doing is trying to make precise the sense in which, limited to the cases that we usually care about, these theories are equivalent to one another. And there's nothing surprising going on here. There's the Legendre transform that takes you between the tangent bundle of a configuration space and the cotangent bundle, and allows you to define a Lagrangian from any Hamiltonian and vice versa, as long as you're, you know, dealing with a particular class of Lagrangians. And then Barrett has gone on subsequently to try to make precise the ways in which you could extend standard presentations of Hamiltonian mechanics and standard presentations of Lagrangian mechanics in such a way that you render them inequivalent once you've sort of moved out of these hyperregular cases where the Legendre transform appears, and trying to, you know, recapture what North and Curiel are talking about. But so, you know, the reason I mention this is because this is the kind of distinction, these are the kinds of things that could count as formulations of a theory. These are the kinds of distinctions that one might try to make. And personally, I'm very sympathetic to this sort of approach, where what we try to do, presented with multiple formulations, isn't stamp our foot and say, no, it's this one or this one, but rather try to characterize as precisely as we can what the relationships between them are, and see if we can come up with some mathematical control over the relationships that are driving these sorts of verdicts about equivalence and inequivalence. Okay, so I'm going to talk about different theories. I'm going to start by talking about classical electromagnetism, because it's easy, everyone knows it. It's got some features that I think end up mattering a lot in other contexts, for instance, in general relativity, Yang-Mills theory. And so I claim electromagnetism emits multiple formulations. I don't mean anything fancy by that, as you'll see. One of those two formulations has, Michael Redhead and Richard Healy put it, surplus structure, superfluous structure, according to Smale and von Frossen, descriptive fluff, according to John Ehrman. Okay, so, you know, you're familiar with this sort of thing. Theories that have this character are sometimes called gauge theories. I wanted to think, I mean, I think that this expression gauge theory gets used for a lot of different things. So sometimes gauge theory is supposed to be synonymous with Yang-Mills theory. And I actually think that that's a pretty misleading thing to, I mean, so running together this idea of excess structure with Yang-Mills theory is a little bit misleading, because I think there are perfectly good formulations of Yang-Mills theory where you don't have that excess structure. In fact, we're going to see just that with the electromagnetism case. But what I have in mind is particularly the usage of the expression gauge theory. What we have in mind is the idea that a formulation of a theory somehow has representational resources that we don't need, that we don't think are capturing any real differences in the world. Okay, I claim that despite this, nonetheless, so only one of the two formulations I think is usually characterized as a gauge theory. Well, in the sense that I have in mind. And yet, you know, if you pick up Jackson, we take these formulations to be doing the same sorts of things for us equally well. And so what I want to be able to do is say as precisely as I can what the senses of equivalence that we have in mind are and what the senses of inequivalence are, and then try to put that to use in other contexts. So the other context is going to be Newtonian gravitation. This is perhaps a little bit less well known, the formulations I'm going to talk about, but it's an example that's maybe more sort of drives people's intuitions a little bit more. And so some of the background in philosophical literature, Clark Leemore is a philosopher of science who, in a series of fairly influential papers, argued that the two formulations of Newtonian gravitation that I'm going to talk about are inequivalent. And I intend to argue that there's a sense in which that's right, but in fact the relationship is exactly the same as the relationship between the two formulations of electromagnetism that I'm going to talk about. So, I mean, I put up these slides where I say there's a sense in which they're equivalent and a sense in which they're inequivalent. You say, well, why don't you make up your mind? But I think that the interesting thing to do here isn't, as I said before, isn't to stamp our feet, but is rather to try to, I mean, I think that there are good reasons to have, to pull in either direction, and that you can learn something by trying to be precise about what's underlying those reasons. Okay, so here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to start by talking about the kinds of formulations of electromagnetism I have in mind. Then I'm going to try to make precise what I mean by surplus structure. And then I'm going to say how we can understand gauge transformations in electromagnetism to, in a sense, restore a certain notion of equivalence. And then I'm going to describe the two formulations of Newtonian gravitation and say how all this stuff plays out. So sections 1 through 3, I think that I'm going to not say anything that isn't very well known. I'm hoping that by sort of organizing it in a way that maybe you haven't seen it organized before, there will be some insights. It may well be that I get stopped a few times along the way. It's not really the end of the world if I have to stop here. So we'll see how things go. Okay, so what do I mean when I say there are two formulations of electromagnetism? Well, what I have in mind is, so it's important that we're limiting attention to Minkowski spacetime because we need to have a simply connected manifold. It's useful to assume that the spacetime is flat. Okay, so here are two ways of characterizing a possible physical configuration allowed by Maxwell's theory. One, I stipulate an electromagnetic field. This is some tensor field, which is required to be closed. So that's just one of Maxwell's equations.
You have a question?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I'm just wondering what theory we're talking about. Is it free electromagnetic field? Is there matter present, continuous media,
charges? Or reason that I'm only stipulating one of Maxwell's theory, one of Maxwell's equations, is that I don't think it matters whether you're assuming that there's. So the kind of thing that I'm imagining would be you've got some smooth charge current distribution, and the other Maxwell equation would say that the divergence of F equals that charge current density.
So as far as what you're saying, we could imagine source free?
We could imagine source free
as well as anything else.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, if you start imagining point sources, then these fields aren't smooth any longer and various things become more complicated. But so let's suppose that everything is smooth. Okay. Here's the other formulation. Our dynamical variable is an F any longer, is now a four-vector potential. And now instead of specifying a value for the electromagnetic field at every point, we suppose that we have a value of the four-vector potential at every point. Now note that I'm not putting any, there's no Maxwell equation here. I don't need one. But whatever I say about sources here, there's a corresponding thing that I would want to say about sources over here.
When you say every point, do you mean every space-time point?
Or yes.
Every
space-time point. Yeah, so I'm thinking we've got Minkowski space-time. It's a four-dimensional manifold with the Lorentzian metric on it. It's flat. It's simply connected. It's complete. And I've got a smooth tensor vector field. Now, I think that these sorts of details don't matter all that much the point that I'm trying to make, which is why I'm suppressing them and trying to. Okay. Now, it should be no surprise these formulations are closely related to one another. You give me a four-vector potential, I can take its exterior derivative to arrive at an electromagnetic field. Conversely, every electromagnetic field corresponds to a four-vector potential satisfying that same relationship. This is what's secured by the fact that F is closed, and the exterior derivative of F vanishes. OK, so of course, there's an asymmetry here. There's a uniqueness in one direction. If you give me a four-vector potential, there's a unique corresponding electromagnetic field. If you give me an electromagnetic field, there are, in general, many four-vector potentials corresponding to it. In particular, you give me any g whose exterior derivative vanishes, then a plus g is going to give rise to the same electromagnetic field that a does. In fact, this condition is equivalent to G being the gradient of some scalar field. So, you know, this is just the ordinary gauge transformations that you find in any textbook on electromagnetism, written in terms of fields on Minkowski spacetime. Okay, so. In what sense should we say that these two formulations are inequivalent? I'm going to start with Gleimore's ideas about equivalence here. This could be a kind of starting point. What Gleimore does is look to logic. And so, of course, physical theories are not, in general, first order theories, or it's not all that helpful to try to think of them as first-order theories. But nonetheless, you can use first-order logic as kind of, think of it as a kind of idealized case. I mean, so there's a notion of theory that we get there. We can think about equivalence of theories and inequivalence of theories in that context. And then we can try to, you know, use the intuitions that we get from that to say something about real physical theories. Okay, and so a natural criterion of equivalence in first-order logic is something called definitional equivalence. The idea is that two first-order theories are definitionally equivalent if they have what's called a common definitional extension. There's not a whole lot to that idea. The picture is, I've got, anyone see that?
Yes.
I've got T1, I've got T2. T1 has a bunch of relation symbols, a bunch of function symbols, some constants. T2 has some relation symbols, some function symbols, some constants. If I can define some theory T, which has as its signature something that has all of the relations and functions and so on in T1, and all the relations and functions in T2, and moreover, I can write down sentences in T that have a particular form and say, well, every relation in T2 holds of some object just in case some sentence is true in T1 and vice versa, then this is a definitional extension of T1 and it's a definitional extension of T2. So the picture is what I'm trying to do is come up with a theory in which I can define everything that I have here in terms of the stuff that I have over here and everything I have over here in terms of the stuff that I have over here. Okay. So this gives me a way of translating between the two theories. Okay, now it's a result of model theory that if two theories are definitionally equivalent, then you can say something about models of those theories, which is that if you give me any model of T1, I can expand it and turn it into a model of T, and then restrict it again to a model of T2. And I can do that in such a way that if I start with a model of T1, turn it into a model of T2, and then go back to a model of T1, I get back to the model that I started with, up to some notion of model isomorphism. Okay, and so I can think of definitional equivalence as a particular sort of claim about the models of these theories. Now, in fact, I've stated this as if it's just a consequence. In fact, this model theoretic characterization is equivalent to definitional equivalence. So I can characterize definitional equivalence entirely in terms of relationship between models of the theories.
I can see why it needs to be invertible, but is there an obvious reason why it has to be a unique translation?
So, is there an obvious way, a reason why, in the first order case, definitional equivalence gives rise to a unique translation?
I'm perfectly happy for it to be true and not obvious.
I think that it is true and that it is obvious, but I'm having, I don't know, there's this problem that I have. The closer I get to a blackboard, the harder it is for me to come up with the obvious things. So.
Are you questioning the theorem or whether we need it to be unique?
I'm not questioning the theorem, but I'm definitely not competent to do that. I was hoping to understand why it had to be unique.
So from a physics point of view, why do we want it to be? Is that your question?
Well, so, I mean,
what would go wrong with the theorem if the word unique was omitted?
That you have two sentences, as it were, in T2, which would both correspond to one sentence in T.
You can have sentences in T1 that are logically equivalent to one another, given T1. And in any case, we're talking about models here. We're talking about translating between models in this.
I'm not sure everyone is so happy with the word model. Can we think like solution of Maxwell's equations?
That's what we're going to end up doing.
Solution of Maxwell's equations in model in formulation 2.
So
we wouldn't want one solution and one formulation to correspond to do two different ones than the other unless...
That's exactly what I'm going to get on to talk about in just a second. So I took the question to be just one about first order logic. And I claim that it's both true and that it is obvious. But I can't tell you why. okay, but so Gleamore extracts from this a criterion of equivalence. And he says, okay, physical theories are theoretically equivalent. And we are really now switching from first order theories to physical theories. And this is a sort of a criterion motivated by the result in first order logic, but not somehow a consequence of it. Okay, so the idea is physical theories are theoretically equivalent if for every model in the first theory, there exists a unique model in the other theory that has the same empirical content as M1. And what I mean by that is just you've got these two formulations. It had better be the case that you can understand, you know, a solution of Maxwell's equations to you know, tell you, make some predictions about the world. And it better be the case that if I've got these two theories, both of them I'm able to come up with solutions and then tell you something about what those solutions represent physically. And if I've got this sort of claim about translation between models of the two theories, it better be the case that, you know, if I'm saying this solution to you know, this vector potential is going to tell me some stuff about, you know, experiments I might try to perform, and this electromagnetic field is going to tell me some stuff. It better be that I'm saying these are somehow corresponding to one another, that they're telling me the same sorts of things empirically. Okay, but then the other part is that we're able to actually define whatever we've got in this model in terms of whatever we've got in this one, and vice versa. Now, I actually think that this condition isn't particularly well formed, but it actually doesn't matter for the claim that follows, because the important thing here is just uniqueness. Whatever else is the case, Gleamore is claiming that you need to have a unique correspondence between models that then have some properties. The salient correspondence between, you know, models of EM1 of electromagnetic fields on Minkowski spacetime and vector potentials on Minkowski spacetime isn't a unique relationship in one direction. Okay, so let me try to spell out what's going on here. I mean, what the sense of excess structure that we have here is. Look, we think that just specifying electromagnetic fields is going to be sufficient to characterize any electromagnetic situation, or electromagnetic fields plus sources is going to be sufficient to characterize whatever it is that we're trying to do with classical electromagnetism. But of course, we think that there are distinct models of this other theory that correspond to a single model of this theory. And so whatever it is that's allowing us to distinguish between these different vector potentials can't be necessary to represent all of the phenomena. Now, of course, I'm speaking entirely classically here, and so you're thinking of things like the Aharonov-Bohm effect, where we start needing to talk about vector potentials, setting that aside. The goal is to make a kind of conceptual point. Okay, so let's try to make this idea precise. Now, I claim that just, you know, if you wander around a math department, you're going to find people talking about all sorts of mathematical gadgets or mathematical structures. You're going to say differ with regard to the amount of structure that they have, but in a way that we can compare. So here are just some straightforward examples. It's natural to think of sets as having less structure than topological spaces. The intuition, well, any topological space is a set with some other stuff, some collection of open sets that satisfy certain axioms. Smooth manifolds have less structure than Lie groups. Why? Well, a Lie group is a smooth manifold that also has a group action. Vector spaces have less structure than inner product spaces. Again, any inner product space is, in particular, a vector space plus something else. Okay. So one way to capture these sorts of relationships is using some very, very basic category theory. So a category is a collection of objects plus some specification of maps between those objects. Those maps have to satisfy some properties. So you always have to have composition of maps. You need to have an identity map for every object. And composition needs to be associative. Here are some concrete categories, categories that have been lurking around your whole life. Maybe you've known that you were working with them, but maybe you haven't. And so you take the objects to be mathematical gadgets of some kind. So you can have a category whose objects are sets, a category whose objects are groups, so on. And then you've got some notion of homomorphism, some notion of map between these sorts of objects. Okay, so you know, if you take a set theory class, you're going to define sets, and then you're going to define functions. Functions are a way of mapping between sets. Group theory class, you're going to define groups, and then you're going to define group homomorphisms, and so on. Okay, and so that sort of data is precisely what it takes to define a category. Okay, now we have a notion of maps between categories as well, known as a functor. So this is going to be a map that takes objects to objects, it takes arrows to arrows, and does so in a way that preserves the sorts of things that I described before. So it takes identity arrows to identity arrows, preserves composition. So big F of F composed with G is going to be big F of F composed with big F of G, things like that. Just what you would expect from algebra, say. Okay, so there's a particular kind of functor that we can think of intuitively as taking the objects of some category and then forgetting something about them. We call these forgetful functors. So here's an example. I can define a category of topological spaces and a category of sets. So the topological, as I said in the previous slide, the topological category of topological spaces is going to have topological spaces as objects. So these are going to be sets with some topology on them. And the arrows are going to be continuous functions. Category of sets is just going to be sets and functions. And so for any topological space, this functor is going to take that topological space just to its underlying set. Oops, X. Of course, every continuous function is in particular a function. And so I can just use the functor to take every continuous function to itself. So intuitively speaking, that's the sort of thing we're trying to describe when we talk about forgetful functors. We're forgetting about the topological structure. And so this should look familiar, right? Because I gave topological spaces and sets as an example of a pair of mathematical gadgets, one of which we intuitively think has more structure than the other. And here we've got a way of describing that category theoretically. Sort of, at least. Because I haven't actually told you what makes a functor forgetful. And so I've given an sort of intuitive characterization. Well, some functors are going to be forgetful. I've given you an example of one. But can we try to say, if you just give me some functor, what, if anything, does it forget? And there's a proposal for how to do this. It requires just a little bit of machinery. The proposal is due to John Baez, Toby Bartel, Jim Dolan. And the idea is, well, we're going to say that a functor, here I'm going to describe three properties that a functor can have. So one property is that a functor can be full. And what that means is I've got, this isn't quite the same as being surjective on arrows. The idea is, look, I've got some objects. I've got a bunch of arrows that are going to go between those. F is going to map to some things over here. And in particular, it's got to take all of the arrows between A and B to arrows between F of A and F of B. The functor is full if for any pair A and B, the induced map on arrows between A and B to arrows between F of A and F of B is surjective. Okay, so you know it may be that that doesn't amount to being surjective on arrows, because it may be that there's some other thing over here that no one over here gets mapped to. And there could be arrows like that. This condition isn't telling me anything about mapping to those arrows. I'm only talking about, you know, for any particular pair over here and C. Okay, so that's what it means for a functor to be full. I'm going to give some examples that will hopefully make this idea clearer. Another notion is faithful, which is sort of corresponding to this. Instead of requiring this map to be surjective, we require for each pair A and B that the map induced on arrows is injective. And then finally, we have called essentially surjective. Now, this isn't a condition on arrows. This is a condition on objects. So it's the requirement that not that every object in this category gets hit by someone from F, but the requirement that every object over here gets hit up to isomorphism. So for every object over here, there's some object isomorphic to it that F maps someone over here to. Okay. So the Baez, Dolan, Bartel, I've added Barrett here because he's the one, Thomas Barrett, who I mentioned earlier, is the one who's actually gone and, you know, carefully proved all this stuff, although it's not particularly hard. It's not as if they didn't know it. Okay, we say that a functor forgets nothing if it satisfies all three of these conditions. And in fact, if that happens, then the functor is essentially invertible. What that means is I can find a functor going in the other direction that takes every object on the right-hand side to an object isomorphic to the object that I started with on the left-hand side. Okay, and so when that happens, we say that the categories are equivalent, and the pair of maps, F and its essential inverse, forms an equivalence of categories. We say that the functor forgets only structure if it's faithful and essentially surjective. So if it's not full, then it forgets only structure. Now, I don't have them on the slides, but the classification allows you to also describe situations where you have full and essentially surjective and full and faithful. So if it's full and faithful, you say the functor forgets only properties. If it's full and essentially surjective, you say it forgets only stuff. And then it turns out that any functor at all can be factored into the composition of functors that forget only one of each of these things. And so in a sense, every functor, except for the ones that forget nothing, so except for equivalences of categories, forgets something. And you can capture in this way the way in which they forget structure, the way in which they forget property, and the way in which they forget stuff by this factorization theorem. I can talk about the intuitions behind the other parts, but let me focus on structure. So the picture here is that this functor I've already described between topological spaces and sets that takes topological spaces to their underlying sets and continuous functions to the underlying functions is going to be essentially surjective because every set can have a topology put on it. The discrete topology always works. Okay, so for every set, there exists some topological space that is going to get mapped to it, at least up to equivalent, up to isomorphism. It's also going to be faithful. The reason is that if I have two distinct continuous functions, in particular, they have to be distinct as functions because they're taken the elements of the sets to different places. Okay, and so any, you know, so no two continuous functions get mapped to the same function. But of course, there are some functions that aren't continuous. And so the functor is not full. And so one way of understanding, okay, so this classification is capturing the sense in which, intuitively speaking, we want to say the topological spaces have more structure than sets. Let me just say maybe one other, put that in one other way that might make the idea more transparent. The idea is that, so if this is the space of the category of topological spaces, I've got a bunch of maps in here that I'm thinking of as, you know, because it's a concrete category, as structure preserving. And the idea is that this functor is giving me a way of thinking about the maps here as maps over here. But since these maps have to be structure preserving, having fewer of them by the standard given by this functor f is capturing the idea that it's harder to preserve the structure that I have over here than it is to preserve the structure that I have over here. A map needs to do more in order to qualify as a continuous map than just as a function. Okay, and so that's, if you've got more structure, you've got fewer structure-preserving maps. And that's what's being captured by this notion of forgetting structure with a functor. Okay, so I claim that this is exactly what's going on with these formulations of electromagnetism. Okay, if we've got a category whose objects are Faraday tensors or electromagnetic fields on Minkowski spacetime, satisfying this condition, and we've got some arrows that correspond to isometries of Minkowski spacetime that also preserve F, in the sense that the push forward along the diffeomorphism corresponding to the isometry takes F, not necessarily to itself, because I could have two different Fs, but takes this F to this F. Similarly, I can define a category whose objects are four vector potentials, whose arrows are space-time symmetries that preserve this. Okay. This map that takes A to its exterior derivative determines a functor. So what I'm doing is I'm taking every object in this category, I'm taking every vector potential, and I'm mapping it to some corresponding Faraday tensor. And this is going to act trivially on arrows, because the arrows in this category are both space-time symmetries that preserve this stuff. And so, in fact, this is a fact about exterior derivatives and push forward to long diffeomorphisms. Any diffeomorphism that preserves A also preserves the exterior derivative of A. And so I can just take any arrow here, and there's going to be the same arrow, the same space-time symmetry is also going to preserve F. And it's easy to see that this functor is essentially surjective and faithful, but not full, using just the stuff that I've already said to you. So every F has some A corresponding to it. And so that makes the functor essentially surjective. It's faithful because, as I just said, every space-time symmetry that preserves A also preserves the exterior derivative of A. But it's not full because there are going to be arrows that preserve a Faraday tensor that don't preserve all of the vector potentials that give rise to it. You can see that very easily if you imagine the simplest Faraday tensor, the one where F equals zero everywhere. Here is a vector potential that gives rise to that Faraday tensor. The exterior derivative of any scalar field at all, as long as it's not constant. every space-time symmetry preserves this. In general, not everyone will preserve this unless psi is constant. Okay. Yeah.
Aren't you putting a burden on these highly symmetric situations? I mean, most fields won't have, they'll just have a trivial
agreed
set of symmetries, and neither will be preserved on either side.
Just
the identity on both sides.
Absolutely, that's true. So the idea here is that we're thinking sort of globally of the space of all solutions on both cases.
Yeah.
And the thing that's doing all of the work isn't that the arrows are somehow encoding all of the information you could possibly care about any particular model. That's certainly not happening here. And so there's an attitude that you sometimes get in category theory or among category theorists that says that somehow all of the structure you could possibly care about mathematical objects of a certain class, is encoded in the category of those objects. I don't think that that's going on here. What I do think is going on is that, so what's being captured here is the claim that any time I've got a map that preserves A, it also preserves the corresponding F.
Right, but those times are very few and far between.
Yes. I mean, I don't know what your measure on
define
a measure space. I've just got a category. But yeah, no, of course, you're right. Nonetheless, it is true that this relationship seems important to us. And the thing that I think ordinarily drives us to say, well, there's excess structure in this A, is the idea that there are a bunch of these that correspond to this.
Right.
And I guess it seems to me helpful to think, to recognize that that kind of case corresponds exactly to the sorts of cases that we generically think of, at least some mathematicians generically think of as cases where in one you have more structure, it's forgotten in this particular way.
That seems definitely true. I'm just saying.
Yeah, no,
this particular category is theoretical. This particular choice of categories and so on.
Sort of impoverished.
Objects and so on.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that you're exactly putting your finger on something that I think of as a problem with the whole approach that I'm trying to give here. So what I'm not trying to, maybe I should have said this at the beginning, I'm not trying to say once and for all, here's what it means for theories to be equivalent, here's what it means for theories to be inequivalent. What I'm trying to do is say, there are some cases where we've got some different formulations of theories where we use different sorts of mathematical objects to do our representational work. Those mathematical objects can on their own bear certain relationships to one another. And this is a useful way of capturing some but not all of those relationships. It's one that allows us, I think, to put our finger on a relationship of interest, but it's not capturing everything. What would capture everything? I'm not sure that there's an answer to that. I don't have it. Okay. So there's another thing that's going to be, I mean, that there's another payoff to this that I'll get to in a moment that maybe will help put you at ease. Okay, so this is another way of spelling out this idea that one of these formulations has surplus structure. It has surplus structure in the sense that I could forget some structure in this precise sense of forgetting structure without affecting empirical adequacy. Okay, now, I want to suggest that this whole way of thinking about mathematical structure gives us a kind of diagnostic tool for identifying cases in which a physical theory has surplus structure in the sense that EM2 has surplus structure. So this is what I think of as a kind of rule of thumb. I'm going to say that a theory, or really a formulation of a theory, has surplus structure if and only if there are non-isomorphic models that have the same representational capacities. So what's going on here is, I mean, a lot of pressure is being put on this here, this idea of non-isomorphic models. But the picture that I'm working with is one where when I'm formulating my physical theories, I'm using some mathematics. There's often a pretty well-defined mathematical theory that I can draw on to characterize the sorts of models I'm going to use in physics. Well-defined mathematical theories tend to come with a notion of equivalence of models, come with a notion of isomorphism. You know, groups come with group isomorphisms. Manifolds come with diffeomorphisms.
Excuse me?
Yeah.
Are you, will you make a statement about the usefulness of this surplus structure? So by saying that theory one or theory two are more useful or less useful, or should one is better than the other because it has or it does not have this surplus structure?
I don't think so. I was taking for granted that, you know, if you've done some classical electromagnetism, you see that there are all sorts of cases where, you know, it's really useful to you know, fix gauge and then, you know, just work with some particular vector potential and then come up with electromagnetic fields later on. But there are other contexts where it's more useful to just work with the electromagnetic fields in the first place. So I was sort of taking for granted that
though they are completely equivalent and the differences in structure do not matter for formulating new theories based on those.
Well, they may matter for formulating new theories. Let me continue and see if you're satisfied. Yeah, there's a story, I think it's from the Shelter Island Conference right after World War II and sort of the beginning of QED, where everyone loved Schwinger and everyone was beating up on Feynman. And people kept stopping Schwinger when he was giving his talk, and he kept doing the same thing, which was to say, you know, pause for a while and then say, perhaps if I continue, it'll become clear. And Feynman thought that was great. He literally wrote home about it, and then when he gave his talk the next day, he tried doing the same thing, and no one let him get away with it. Okay. But perhaps if I continue, it will become clear. okay, so if you're using this rule of thumb, here are, it makes some rulings that I think might seem a little bit surprising. So Yang-Mills theory, at least if you formulate it as a theory of a connection on a principal bundle, doesn't have any surplus structure. The things that we think of as gauge transformations just correspond to, I think, what are naturally understood as the isomorphisms of the models. I mean, so if you say, look, a model of this theory is some principal bundle with some connection on it, then a principal bundle isomorphism that preserves that connection is the natural candidate mathematically for an isomorphism of that structure. Those isomorphisms are in the ones that act trivially on the base space are in one-to-one correspondence with the what we otherwise think of as gauge transformations. And so here there aren't non-isomorphic models that are physically equivalent. I can come up with other ways of characterizing Yang-Mills theory, of course. Analogous to EM2, where I do have excess structure in the exact same way that I do in EM2. I basically specify a particular choice of gauge. But I've got a totally gauge-independent characterization. General relativity, again, no surplus structure by this criterion. I think it's natural to think of isometries as the isomorphisms of relativistic spacetimes. And so, of course, I can add in excess structure, but from this point of view, what I'm doing is, fixing, say, some coordinate system, which is very closely analogous, I claim, to fixing some particular choice of vector potential. I can then talk about the maps that move between those vector potentials, or the maps that move between those coordinate systems. But I've got a way of characterizing models of the theory in such a way that I don't have any non-isomorphic models that have the same representational capacities.
Can I ask a clarification?
Yeah.
So in the EM example, we had two formulations that were empirically equivalent, and we judged the vector potential would have surplus structure because there was a functor from one to the other that forgot structure. So when I'm making a similar judgment of general relativity, is the claim that there is no reformulation of general relativity that has that relation to standard formulation?
In a sense, so what's going on with this rule of thumb, what's doing all the work here, is the idea that in EM1 and EM2, or I guess in EM2 in particular, I've got some models that I already think have the same representational capacities, and which I think it's hard to see how I would call them isomorphic just by looking at how I'm describing the models. Given that, it seems like, if I could come up with another category where those things are isomorphic to one another, then I'm going to have a natural candidate for a functor that is going to forget structure. In these cases, where I don't, if I formulate these in the right way, where I don't have those sorts of physically equivalent, but somehow mathematically inequivalent models, it's implausible that I'm going to come up with a category of the sort that I can come up with in the electromagnetism case. So that's why I call it a rule of thumb. But the picture is, well, I'm going to say this in a moment. But the picture is one where in EM2, there's a sense in which there are some arrows missing. And I'm suggesting that sort of a natural way of characterizing these theories, those arrows aren't missing. Yeah?
So I'm having a hard time seeing the difference between the U1 theory or the abelian gauge theory and the not abelian gauge. I would have thought that you could say anything you could say about one, you could say about the other.
You can. I agree
and
with that.
And yet you.
Yes, because so this is why I said the stuff about how to formulate the Yang-Mills theory. Let me say the rest of what I have to say about electromagnetism and then come back to this point rather than talking about Newtonian gravitation, unless there are huge complaints. Because I've already been going for an hour and I'm a little bit nervous that...
These tend to go a little longer.
Okay.
I don't know. I'm not the chair.
I mean, I think that this is an important point. So I'm happy to dwell on it. But I think it'll be easier to make the point if I say one more thing. Okay, so... how would we recover a sense of equivalence between EM1 and EM2? So the idea here is just that, here's my other funny picture. We've got a class of transformations. So the idea is supposed to be, I'm supposed to have convinced you now that EM1 and EM2 are inequivalent in a way that I can make precise. One of them has more structure than the other. And yet we've got people going around acting as if they're equivalent. I take the kitten to be me, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we've already, I mean, again, already when you read Jackson or, you know, any, whatever your favorite electromagnetism textbook is, you've got a class of maps that you're using to characterize the relationships between these four vector potentials. Right? These gauge transformations. Now, you're brought up to think, look, any four potentials that are related by gauge transformations are physically equivalent. That's just stipulated when you define the gauge potential in the first place. And so the kind of inequivalence we're getting turns out to be inequivalence up to something that we can characterize. It's kind of inequivalence up to this additional notion of physical equivalence that's captured by the gauge transformation. Now, I claim that there's not a natural way to sort of tweak Gleimore's criterion to capture this notion of, you know, unique one-to-one translation of models up to some notion of physical equivalence. But the category theory gives us a nice way of capturing this idea. Well, the idea is that this function that I started with, the sense in which it forgets structure is that it fails to be full. One way of thinking about that, I've already alluded to, is that this category here can be thought of as missing some arrows. Right, so F is taking the arrows over here to the arrows over here, but there are more of them over here than there are over here. Not literally more, because I mean they're continuum many in both cases. But there are some over here that don't get hit by any over here. I can think of the gauge transformations, which I'm already thinking of as maps between vector potentials, as characterizing another kind of arrow between the objects of this category. And with that intuition, I can define a new category where I've simply added some arrows. I can do this in various ways, and I can show that, in fact, I get a category by doing it. But the picture is just I'm going to have an arrow between two objects if there's a space-time symmetry that takes the vector potential to the other vector potential, or there's a space-time symmetry that takes the vector potential in this object to a vector potential that's gauge equivalent to the one in this model over here. Okay. So that adds a whole bunch of new arrows to EM2, and it turns out that that's exactly what I need to make exactly the functor that, what functor? G is supposed to be. The functor that I haven't defined. Okay. Well, the functor that takes, that does what you'd expect it to do. How about that? That functor forgets nothing. Okay, so this is the thing that I was saying. I want to hedge on a bit. I think that there's a sense of equivalence that's being captured here, but it's not everything that one might want. But the idea is that I can use this notion of categorical equivalence to capture a kind of relationship between the models that I'm using in my two different theories here. And that criterion is one that allows me to say, well, EM1, the one with Faraday tensors, the one with electromagnetic fields, is not equivalent to EM2 as I originally described it, where I don't have gauge transformations. But once I've added the gauge transformations in, then I capture the equivalence again. OK, and so the thing that's sort of the insight here is the idea that there's already this relationship between different kinds of mathematical structures that some mathematicians talk about and use category theory to talk about that puts a lot of weight on the relationships between structure-preserving maps. Of course, physicists spend a lot of time talking about gauge transformations, also talking about formulations of theories that have different amounts of structure but are in some sense equivalent and in some sense inequivalent. And in fact, the maps that we think of as gauge transformations are doing to that excess structure exactly the thing that you would need them to in order to recover the kind of equivalence that one would like. So I take this to just be sort of spelling out in maybe some more detail relationships between things that we think about all the time, but which maybe weren't obviously connected to one another. Okay, so what's the relationship between these criteria? Well, first of all, this is probably obvious, but criterion 2 is strictly weaker than criterion 1. Now, I take criterion 1 to the Gleamor criterion, the definitional, the one motivated by definitional equivalence, to capture a kind of equivalence between our modes of description. It requires intertranslatability, and I think of that as capturing a kind of, you might call, syntactic notion of equivalence. Whereas criterion 2, at least in the cases where we have sufficiently rich categories, which it's not clear that we actually do here, but is capturing something that you might think of as an equivalence between the physical possibilities themselves that are described by the theory. So the idea is that you can have different ways of describing, in the same way that you can have different ways of describing the same mathematical objects, you can have different ways of describing given physical situations. And you can try to draw distinctions between the methods of description, but you could also try to characterize the relationships between the things that we're actually describing. I think that criterion 2 is doing a somewhat better job of that. But I think it's also drawing attention to the way in which we use mathematical structures to represent physical situations. And in particular, the idea that we often have more than one physical, more than one mathematical object that corresponds to the same physical situation, or it could be used to represent the same physical situations. In some cases, those are going to be isomorphic just as mathematical objects. And in some cases, they're not. It seems to me that the important way of thinking about that is to emphasize the maps that we have between these objects. Now, I take this to be a kind of important moral, which is that one thing that you might try to do when presented with physically equivalent models that aren't obviously isomorphic is to somehow take an equivalence class between them, of them. And I want to suggest that, at least from this perspective, that's not the right thing to do, because there may be more than one way in which these things are equivalent to one another. What you're really trying to do is figure out a way of mapping between them that preserves the structure that you think matters. Okay, and so that's why the suggestion is we should look to identify the invertible maps that preserve the shared structure. So it's not necessarily, it seems to me, going to be the case that it's somehow the stuff that all of our models have in common when somehow characterized in a flat-footed way, that's going to be what we actually need to do the work that we care about. It's often going to be... Maybe I'll stop and let people ask me questions about that. And I think that this... is a good place for me to finish the talk and go to Raphael's question about Yang-Mills theory.
Well, I have to run out and sign something, but I can come back. I don't know if it's a good...
Okay, so then I won't answer
your... answering my question.
You can go, and then we can also talk. So I guess I'm stopping.
What about you had the list.
Oh yeah. There's more that I can say if you want me to. But I just feel as if I've been droning on now for an hour and 15 minutes.
Can I just ask you about that slide?
Yeah.
It's not clear to me why we should quotient by an equivalence. So take EM1 and EM2. The natural thing to say is, well, an electromagnetic field is represented by an equivalence class of gauge equivalent vector potentials. And that was what I was tempted to say all the while you're talking. I'm not sure why I should not continue to be tempted to say that.
So I take it to be a consequence of the other stuff, that it turns out that there is a kind of shared structure between all of these models, a structure that I can characterize sort of independently of any particular vector potential. But in some ways, I think that's an accidental feature of this case. And so here's something else that you might try to do. Suppose you give me a category that has Lorentzian manifolds as its objects. I notice, well, isometric Lorentzian manifolds seem to encode all of the same physical information. This is a much more controversial perspective that I'm about to advocate for. But it seems like one thing that many people have tried to do in response to that situation is to say, well, that means that what I need to do is find some object that somehow intrinsically characterizes all of the stuff that all of those Lorentzian manifolds have in common. Now, I think that there are ways in which you can do that, but I think the flat-footed way of saying, well, what I'm now going to do is represent the universe by an equivalence class of Lorentzian manifolds isn't going to be particularly helpful.
So there are cases where that move is not particularly helpful.
That seems right to me. So what you really want to do is say, well, what is the structure that all of these models, in fact, have in common with one another? What's the structure that all Lorentzian manifolds have in common with one another? And you can say some stuff about what that structure is. So it's going to be, for instance, information about point coincidences of physical fields or of curves. They're also going to all share information about distances between events as measured along various curves, duration between events as measured along time-like curves, things like that. So all of that is stuff that's going to be preserved. If you can come up with a characterization that has all of that stuff, then that's great. It's not at all clear to me that an equivalence class, or what you get if you quotient by isometry, are objects that do in some natural sense represent all of that stuff. And so, there are lots of mathematical examples that you can think about that sort of have this character. One way of thinking about it is there are lots of cases where a symmetry or symmetry groups, so just sets, for instance, the automorphism groups of sets, so all of the maps that take you from the set to itself, all the functions that take you from a set to itself, fully characterize all of the information that you care about just set structure, right? I mean, it tells you how many elements the set has. Now, if I say invertible functions represent a kind of equivalence, and I want to now try to get to the true set structure by equivocating, basically by quotienting by all of those invertible functions, what I get isn't something that tells me about the intrinsic set structure. What I get is an object, a single object, with a single map from it to itself. And so equivocating in that way by invertible functions, or quotienting out by invertible functions, isn't giving me any interesting information about set structure. It's reducing everything to a set with a single element. And I don't know, does that?
Yeah, so there are cases in which that would not be a useful thing, but perhaps there are cases in which it is a useful thing.
Well, I think that there are cases where it turns out, for essentially accidental reasons, to work out that way. That
it's a useful thing to do. But I
don't think that it should be the first arrow out of our quiver. So the idea is, you know, there are sort of other things you want to try to do, and then see if you can, you know, figure out that, oh, there's a sort of nice intrinsic way of characterizing these things.
So it shouldn't be the default mode.
Yeah, that's...
Okay.
So here's how it ends up working in Yang-Mills theory. So I've got... some principal bundle over a space-time manifold. And I've got some principal connection on P. Now, in the abelian case, I can think of, so let's just, I mean, let's stick to the electromagnetism case that I've already described. Now in this language, and then sort of generalize the non-abelian case in a moment. But so I'm going to assume that this is R4. So I'm over Minkowski space-time. And I'm assuming that this is U1, so it's an abelian group. And so this is some principal connection on this. I've got some, because this is simply connected, I've got some global section, got a bunch of global sections, in fact, which are maps from M to P. I can use any choice of section to represent this object as some vector field on M. That's what I'm going to think of as a vector potential. Choosing different sections are going to give rise to different vector potentials. These are going to be, in the abelian case, related by the gauge transformations I've already talked about. Where G is closed. OK, so the idea is that if what I've got, oh, so I guess maybe let me mention one other fact. So associated with the connection, of course, I can define a curvature, which in the abelian case is just equal to the exterior derivative of omega. I can consider this represented on M relative to a section as well. That, of course, is just going to equal this. I'm not using indices, so I should drop that. Which is going to equal what I otherwise called F. Because this is abelian, this pulled back along any section is independent of the choice of section. And so I always get the same F no matter what. And so just as a translation manual, choice of section corresponds to choice of gauge. I've got this, in some sense, invariant geometrical object defined on P that can be represented on M in a number of different ways corresponding to different choices of gauge. But in fact, the exterior derivative of that thing, which is a curvature, is independent of the choice of gauge. And so what I was describing as EM1 was just specifying this. But I claim that in the abelian case, just specifying this, or just specifying this, is the same as just specifying this. What I was calling EM2 was a a U1 bundle over Minkowski space-time with a connection on it plus a particular choice of section relative to which I was representing stuff on space-time. And so what I'm getting rid of when I equivocate between vector potentials, what I'm getting rid of when I add in gauge transformations, is the extra information corresponding to a particular choice of section. But from this point of view, I can think of the maps that take me from A to A prime as corresponding to changes of section, which corresponds to maps from P to itself that have certain nice properties that have, you know, so if I call that F, it can be such that sigma equals F after sigma prime. And so if gauge transformations are going to correspond to changes of section, those now turn out to be isomorphisms of this structure that preserve omega. And so what's happened here is that maps that I previously wasn't thinking of as isomorphisms, that I was in some sense putting in by hand, now turn out to be isomorphisms by choosing the right mathematical structure. And so, Wayne, I guess I tend to think that what we really are trying to do is, if we've got these cases where we think these things are physically equivalent but not isomorphic, is to try to identify which sort of mathematical structure is the one such that those maps that we're tempted to put in by hand really do count as isomorphisms in a natural way. And when that happens, it will often turn out that there's some invariant structure that we can hold on to. Here, both omega and little omega and big omega are examples of that invariant structure.
Why do you say little omega is invariant? If you make a local gauge transformation on P, I think little omega is going to change, if I understand what little omega is.
So
is not your connection on the principal bundle?
So I'm not claiming that, oh, this is so much nicer.
Yeah.
I'm not claiming that that is true. No, what I'm claiming is that every map F like that is going to allow me to define a new connection on P. That's isomorphic. So if I'm thinking of my models as principal bundles with connections on them. This is the same as what you would say about isometries in relativity theory. I can say, well, here's another connection that I can put on P. If I'm thinking about one manifold, I can think of these as two different connections. But in fact, I know by construction that there's a map that takes this to this, that takes P to itself and takes omega to the pullback of omega along F.
In fact, it's F.
I think it's actually F inverse.
Yeah. Okay, but is there meant to be some difference between this and the non-abelian case? Or?
No, there isn't. So the point is supposed to be that now in the non-abelian case, I've got some connection on P. It's no longer going to be true that the curvature of that connection is independent of the choice of section. And so I can't just say, well, I should look at the equivalent of F. What I can do is I can say, well, let's just look at the connection on the principal bundle and recognize that these are appropriate. I mean, these are the analogs to isometries in this setting. And that's the sense in which I think there aren't that gauge transformations are naturally construed as isomorphisms already if you're thinking about a connection on a principal bundle.
So
Whereas, of course, the other thing I could do is add this additional choice and say, well, what I care about are actually fields on M. And so I'm going to, in the non-abelian case, take omega and omega and represent them as fields on M relative to some particular choice of section. And that puts me back in EM2 territory.
So is your point that there's no analog of the capital F in the non-abelian case?
Is that yes.
The key thing? But there is, I mean, there are analogs, they're just not local fields. I mean, Wilson loops and so on are analogs of those. That same sort of thing.
Sort of. I mean, in order to get a Wilson loop, you need to choose a representation of the structure group. And.
Well, choose could, one.
Yeah, but. Or, you know, why'd you choose yours? I've got my favorite. I mean, but it depends on what dimension you're talking about, right? So.
Anyway, that I think that's.
So you need to be able to take a trace. Of a holonomy. So you need to be able to take a trace of a Lie algebra element, or a Lie group element, actually. And you can only
if you choose one base point or something, you can capture everything for holonomies. I don't think that there's any essential.
So
I don't see any real distinction.
With holonomies, you can do it. But Wilson loops have less structure than holonomies.
Let's say holonomies.
Yeah. But so I claim that there's a natural way in which you can define you give me a manifold and you give me a holonomy map. So I pick some base point of M, and what this is going to do is going to give me a map like that. So it's going to assign to closed curves based at x some Lie group element. It's got to satisfy some additional properties, of course. But you're going to get a categorical equivalence between the collection of all of these with isomorphisms if you define them in the right way.
Well, you will, but I'm just saying that the H is your analog of your F in the case.
I'm not sure that I agree with that exactly, because in the abelian case, I've got F and I've got H. It's not like they're the same thing.
I mean, it plays, well, I don't know if it's an important point or not.
It just, I can understand it to play that role. But the point is that I can understand omega on P to play that role too. And I've got non-trivial isomorphisms
omega.
Between these that I should care about.
Right.
Yeah,
we just see if anyone else has a question.
Sorry. I know it's been going on a long time, but I was just dying to see you had Yang Mills general relativity, both of ones don't have, and I was waiting to see what happened if you put field theory or something else in there. You had that, you started and you had no forgetting, or I forget now, what was the, anyway, I was all set to get really excited by.
And then I disappointed you.
Yeah, and you just never got to it.
Which?
Well, you had a slide that. Okay, can somebody help me with something?
You want to see the outline of the coffee in?
No, just the.
So the only thing that I skipped, I mean. I think this is being recorded, right? So I've got to actually, I have to.
Yeah,
there's a whole other talk about gravity that I'm not,
okay.
As it turns out, not going to give.
Okay.
But just say a few more words about.
Well, there was this slide that you had.
I said general relativity, no surplus structure.
No surplus, yeah.
And then Yang-Mills theory,
no
surplus structure.
So it's a waiting to see once some surplus structure.
What does have some surplus structure?
Yeah.
Oh, so I think Yang-Mills theory, if I characterize it in terms of a particular choice of section like this, has surplus structure. I was going to claim that Newtonian gravitation, standardly formulated, where I've got some classical space-time structure with a gravitational potential on it, that has surplus structure. In the exact same way that electromagnetism does. But here, I think, is a case where it's awfully difficult to do the thing that Wayne was describing. So I can say, let's say that two models of Newtonian gravitation are physically equivalent to one another. If I've basically changed my notion of unaccelerated trajectory and introduced an appropriate gravitational field to offset that change in just the right way. Now, I can always do that. In fact, there are infinitely many ways in which I can do that for any model of Newtonian gravitation. But if I just take the equivalence class of all of those things, it's not really clear that I've got a space-time any longer. What you can do is move to another, you know, move to Newton-Cartan theory. And you can then see that from the general point of view described here, that moving to Newton-Cartan theory amounts to exactly the same thing as adding in these extra arrows corresponding to equivocating the way that I suggest one does between these physically equivalent models of ordinary Newtonian gravitation. I think one way of understanding, so this is sort of inside baseball for the physicists, sorry. One way of understanding what Simon Saunders has been doing recently on Newtonian space-time structure is a way of trying to characterize this stuff without moving to Newton-Cartan theory.
Okay, I think we should end the official
stop.
Final.
Yeah, thank you.